Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We welcome you to the Waves of Radio Islam International this Tuesday morning. It is the Tajir program. In this program, we unpack and we discuss various business, economics, and financial issues, financial masail. Our guest on this program is Mufti Muhammad Hafiji. Mufti Saab is from the Jamiatul Ulama South Africa's Economics and Finance Desk. Mufti Saab has joined us in the studio this morning. We welcome him on the program. Mufti Saab, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. To yourself, Mulana, and to all our listeners of Radio Islam.
How are you keeping this week, Musa?
Alhamdulillah, through your du'as, through Allah Ta'ala's grace and mercy and the well-wishing of our listeners, nothing to complain about, and just looking forward to what is in store for the next hour or so, inshallah.
Inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make it a means that we can all learn and we can all benefit from this program.
Ameen, inshallah.
We do remind the listeners our program is broken up into different segments. This week's program we'll be taking a look at this week. Thereafter we have a very interesting interview coming up in Eye Openers, and then lastly we'll move on to Fiqh of Commerce. We do remind the listeners if you have any queries, anything on your mind, if it is business, economics or finance related, then you can call us on 011-854-1548, 011-854-1548, or you could SMS it to us, your questions, your queries, or WhatsApp it to us, 083-379-4235. We will start off this week's program with BizWeek Consumer Highlights.
BizWeek on the Al-Tajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Starting off this week's program, Mufti Saab, something that's very interesting and very worrying at the same time, old age pension fraud on the increase.
Yes, Mulana, you know, state pension for old age individuals is virtually a pittance. 1,400 rand a month is not really much to sustain a life. But be it as it may, there is a rise in terms of the fraud that is taking place in terms of pension. And the specific form of fraud is where individuals would be, you know, would be surprised to find that rather than receiving their usual 1,400 rand, suddenly you start receiving 900 rand a month, you know. When you inquire a little bit more, you find out that there's been a direct deduction on that account, and as a result, you're sitting with less money. Now, according to the report I was looking at, it does seem like most of the fraud is on the part of some of the officials who are managing the dispensation of pension funds, you know, pension allowances. So it is from their part. So many times a typical occurrence would be like an old person would come forward, and you have to enter a PIN for your card, and you don't know, you know, they're asking you for a PIN. As an old person, you don't really realize what to do, how long should the PIN be, how should it be, you know. So they suggest to you, you know, just put the first four digits of your ID number, you know. And you innocently, you give in, you type the first four digits, and those first four digits are easily obtainable by that that specific agent and that consultant. So the PIN is accessible to that person, and then you have that person creating a direct deduction in terms of maybe some prepaid airtime or some loan agreement in your name or something of that sort. So the main thing is to ensure that older people should be assisted by a close family member or someone who has their interest at heart in terms of the whole procedure of claiming their pension from the state. There are a few specific scenarios and safeguards that we could do. Number one is obviously choosing a four-digit PIN yourself and not taking a PIN which is suggested by anyone or at least by someone who you don't know. You know, you're taking a suggestion from a person you don't know in terms of your PIN. That's quite dangerous. Usually the pension fund adjudicator or even the state pension coordinator, your SESA, they do not usually phone you to confirm specific information. So if anyone does phone you and claim to be from SESA and is asking for personal information, you should be on your guard. You rather contact the office yourself rather than them contacting you. There's another tip in terms of if you forget your PIN, rather than renewing it in any other way, the best way, safest way, is to do it through going to the SESA office to reset the PIN. And then finally, if the card is lost or stolen, a person can contact the help desk to put a stop on that card and then get an affidavit from the police station in terms of what happened exactly. I must emphasize, Mona, just in closing on the point of the fraud, there is only one direct deduction which the state allows from a state pension, and that is the aspect of a person being subscribed to a funeral policy. I'm not suggesting a funeral policy is permissible to suggest. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about the what the law stipulates in terms of a direct deduction on a pension. The only one that is allowed is the one for a funeral policy. Only in that case can a direct deduction be taking place. So instead of the individual receiving their usual 1,400 rand, they would be receiving now 900 rand as a result of making a direct deduction to a funeral policy. That's in the event of the funeral policy, which is usually non-permissible as it is.
Well, Mustafa, you know, old people and funeral policy, I think they link it up.
That's the main reason. The main reason is it's an old person and they are likely to need funeral policy. So as a result, this one deduction is allowed in terms of the laws.
Okay, tell us, consumer journalists creating awareness around prescribed debt.
Yes, on a prescribed debt, I'm going to define what prescribed debt is. I think we've talked about it very early in 2014 sometime. But prescribed debt is basically a defense which a person can raise against a creditor that this debt that I owe you is prescribed. Meaning that a period of time has passed or lapsed wherein I have denied owing this amount. I have not made any payment or made any promise to pay this specific debt. So hence this debt is prescribed. More than 3 years have passed. I'm just using an example. More than 3 years have passed on this amount that I owe you. Hence the debt is prescribed. You cannot claim it from me. Now, this kind of defense is available in terms of South African law. But it is important for Muslims to keep in mind, Muslim practitioners, legal practitioners also, who aid and assist their clients in terms of filing a claim of the sort or defending a claim of the sort. Prescribed debt is something from an Islamic perspective has to really be looked at very carefully, in the sense that from an Islamic perspective, you only become absolved of your debt obligation if you settle it, number one. You settle the amount and that's it. You know, there's nothing straightforward settlement of the debt. Or the creditor himself or herself waives the debt and makes it clear that you do not have to owe me this money. You know, that's the second scenario where a debt is waived. The third one is possibly which is highly unlikely to occur in our current political circumstances, where an Islamic court absolves a person as a result of maybe their overwhelming debt. The court says that this individual is now regarded as insolvent and is unable to perform anymore on his debt, so the creditor will have to lose out. You know, so those are three basic circumstances in terms of a person being absolved from their debt. But it doesn't mean that the South African law allows the defense of prescribed debt, therefore you can use it as a defense. You know, it doesn't mean you haven't paid your example, some subscription of yours. You haven't paid it for 3 years and you want to raise a defense and tell the company that you cannot pursue me anymore, this debt is prescribed. Mm. It may not necessarily be in keeping with Islamic laws of settlement of debt. So, yes, consumer journalists have been raising some kind of awareness about exercising your rights and what kind of rights are available in law to keep yourself protected, you know, from your creditors. But Islamically, keep in mind, there's a different perspective altogether.
Okay, that's very interesting. Side effects of the skills levy on the private sector.
Yes, you know, when we're talking about the private sector, we're referring to specific corporations, you know, like companies that pay a skills levy, which is call it a tax that the companies have to pay for the upliftment of the coming generation. I'm just putting it really simply, right? So the skills levy was introduced in 1999, and yes, ever since then, the private sector has been giving towards this specific skills levy. But in the process, there's been a very interesting side effect of the skills levy. In recent years, we've noticed that these companies have actually started giving less bursaries now to individuals who are willing to take up studies. So let's take an example to simplify the whole matter. Let's say Eskom at one point in time were granting 1,000 bursaries for engineering. As a result of the skills levy, the company now starts giving 600 bursaries rather than 1,000. Because they already have a burden of the skills levy, call it the tax, and then now the bursaries as well. So as a result of the skills levy, we find that the companies are now giving less bursaries. It's just one of the side effects of the skills levy itself. But I must go on to say that in terms of the South African expenditure on tertiary education, and we'll see much more about this tomorrow in the budget speech, it's quite interesting to note that we actually weigh quite competitively to other countries. And what I mean is that in South Africa, we're currently spending about 6.2% of GDP on education. right? If you look at, even if you don't understand what 6% of GDP means, look at what other countries are spending. The USA are spending 5.2% of GDP on tertiary education. The UK, 6% of GDP on education. Mexico, 5.1% of GDP. Pakistan, 2.5% of GDP. So South Africa spending 6.2% of GDP on education is quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's already a bit. And we are likely to see the minister talking about an additional 30 billion, additional funds, which is going to be injected towards tertiary education. So 30 billion, it's quite a whopping amount. But I must say that we fare quite competitively in terms of our allocations to tertiary education. And the specific aspect of this is a typical example for us to understand that when you impose a tax, there are definite side effects and ways in which people react. The taxpayer has to react to that specific tax. So in this case, we're seeing the skills levy on one hand. On the other hand, the same payer of that tax, mm-hmm. but then reduces the amount of granting of bursaries.
Okay, so it's like drop the one to cover for the
another, yes.
Cost of healthcare in South Africa in inquiry, obviously something very, very interesting.
Yes, Monana, this is something that, you know, the minute a person is diagnosed with any severe illness, it's almost like not a death threat, but a death trap. You know, it's not a death threat, death threat. Mm. It's a debt trap. In the sense that the bills, the costs of that ailment is just so exorbitant in the South African context. And it comes as no surprise that finally the Competition Commission is carrying out an inquiry into private sector healthcare. This inquiry is currently ongoing. The commission believes that the general investigation is in terms of the state, the nature and form of competition in the market, rather than a narrow investigation into a specific product. So they're not only looking, for example, into discovery healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, it's looking at the market as a whole in terms of what kind of barriers are there to entry, what kind of competition is free competition is allowed for the benefit of consumers. So all these kind of issues are being looked at by the Competition Commission, and I found it really staggering to find the World Health Organization made a submission recently to the Commission stating that in South Africa only 17% of the population can afford private healthcare. Only 17% of the population affords private healthcare, which is quite staggering. And in terms of our private healthcare costs, we actually fare with countries with much higher GDP levels. So, in fact, our costs are much more in line with countries like the UK, Germany, France, whereas we don't enjoy the same amount of GDP as those nations. So it doesn't make real sense. And this is why we're probably feeling the pinch in terms of being able to absorb the cost of private health care. So this is an interesting commission and an inquiry by the Competition Commission. There's an interesting individual who is making waves from a company called Section 27, Mark Haywood. The individual who is concerned with he takes up public interest affairs, you know. And what I admire about the initiative is that he's making a voice and making himself heard on behalf of many South Africans in a platform that matters, you know, making submissions to the Commission in terms of what the situation is in terms of private health care.
Okay. As you said, Muftsap is probably giving a voice to approximately about, 83% of the population, 17% can afford it. So
that's where energy should be diverted in terms of the kind of projects we take up. If you look at what the individual is doing through Section 27.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We welcome you back to Radio Islam International. This is the Tajir program. And in this program, we are unpacking various business and economics scenarios that come up. We move on now to the second segment of our program, and that is Eye Openers.
Eye Openers on the At Tajir Hour.
In South Africa, there are an estimated 600 in-store bakeries in the major supermarket groups, 250 franchise bakeries, and over 4,500 small independent bakeries. Now, it is estimated that each South African consumes approximately 63 loaves of bread a year. And on average, one in three South Africans bake for pleasure, and interestingly, all age groups enjoy this pastime. In terms of population groups, more South Africans of Indian origin bake for pleasure, followed by whites, coloureds and blacks. No matter how much we enjoy a homemade confectionery, there are times when even the best of bakers would prefer to buy a tasty treat from a bakery. Today's eye-opener is a newly established bakery in the southern suburbs, and we have the owner, Brother Khalid Qazi, on the line to give us an idea of what it takes to start a new bakery brand. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Brother Khalid, and welcome to the Attajir Hour.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. JazakAllah for having us.
Alhamdulillah, it's a great pleasure to have you on air today with us, on Eye Opener specifically. And now, Brother Khalid, you know, just I'm trying to determine the motivation for starting the business. So can you give us an idea of where and when was the idea of opening a bakery born?
Okay, the answer is to add that the bakery is co-owned. That's myself and my partner, Farhad Qazi. And the idea was born approximately about 2 years ago. I was still in the corporate field, and Farhad was had his own business, and we old school friends, and we decided we're looking to do something together.
Okay. Now, okay, I do understand the name of the business is La Bakery, and La in Arabic generally stands for, it means no, you know, no bakery. And so can you give us a peep into the naming of the business? Why have you given it the name La Bakery? Where does that come from?
Okay, once we found the site and we decided we're going into the bakery, obviously we needed to choose a name.
Mm-hmm.
And there were various options. We gave it out to family and friends and asked them to come up with suggestions. Some of it was rather extreme, like let them eat cake. Mm-hmm. And we thought of Cake Boys because it's two of us. And then eventually then we decided on plain and simple one to call it The Bakery. But then you've obviously got family members that decided to be a bit more fancy and said, let's go with a sort of like French patisserie theme and let's go with La Bakery.
So it's French. It does go back to French.
That's what it goes with, yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, now, you know, I've been to the store, and it does seem like the store immaculate. I can confidently say it's quite immaculate, right? And it does convey an impression that a lot of planning has gone into the business. Can you give us an idea of how much of time, for how long was the business in a planning stage?
We got confirmation around about November 2014 that the shop was available. We signed everything in December, and then we set about deciding on everything, how we're going to do it. And from the onset, we said we wanted the bakery to be different from your normal traditional bakeries and to have a bit of class to it and make it look a bit more different. I'm not sure if you noticed the display window as well that we've got to the side of the store.
Yes, very different to the normal conventional style.
Yeah, as well as the antique items that we've got throughout the store on the shelves and that. So we wanted to have it a bit to make it different. And then from December onwards, we took ownership of the shop in January, and that's when we started doing the actual construction of the bakery, how we're going to plan it out, and what decor we're going to use. Alhamdulillah, we had a lot of input from friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
And we had someone come on board that had a flair for this. That,
could I assume that there's been some feminine involvement here? This is very, very female-like setting.
Yeah, there was. Okay. You can't do anything without the fair sex. So, yeah, no, there was.
Yes,
but
yes.
Most of the stuff, Rad and I said, okay, this is what we want to do, this is how we want to set it up and that. But obviously there was involvement, yeah.
Okay, sounds good. Now, you know, it goes without saying that any bakery hinges on a specific person there. And that person is not so much the owner or the person giving the funding, but actually the baker. So what mechanisms have you in place to deal with a prospective loss of a key person, such as a baker? Assuming I want to start a bakery and I offer a better package to your baker, sort of mechanisms do you have in place to protect yourself?
Okay, what we've done from the beginning, obviously the first few months or so, we were quite dependent on the individual and that, and you got to make sure that you look after your staff and that, and we're quite fair and open with them. This is what we require from them, this is how we want to do stuff, and then obviously them coming from previous baking industries, they come with their own ideas, and then we tell them that this is how we want to do it, and we get them onto that track. I must add that Farhad does come from a previous baking experience where his brother had the first bakery in Lanesia South. So we didn't go in, how can I say, with eyes closed completely. We did have some experience in terms of what we wanted and how we want to do it.
Okay.
So to overcome the aspect of losing someone, whatever, we've made sure Shukr Alhamdulillah, when we started off, we had about six guys at the back. we're now sitting at about 11 guys. So what we've done is we sort of cross-trained them so that there's always some circumstances where they can't make it to work today or they're not coming in, so that you know you've got a backup.
Yes.
The person next to them can jump in and carry on like that. So we've sort of multi-skilled them. We've got at least two or three guys per section that knows how to do it.
Okay. Now, you know, the thing is, value creation is a key component in the success of any business. Now, in what ways are you, as the owner or co-owner of La Bakery, endeavoring to add value to the overall customer experience? What I mean is, like, do you have, like, freebies or competitions or some kind of discounts on volume purchases? Or in what ways are you creating some kind of value for the overall customer experience?
Look, the thing is, what we said from the start is, we want it to be different, and we want to give a quality product. And the ingredients that we put in, we source the best ingredients. Yes, they might be slightly more expensive or whatever, but at the end of the day, the customer doesn't mind paying a few rands more knowing that they're getting a quality product. Mm. And obviously the service they're getting from us as well. Farhad and I, at all times, either one of us is in the business to make sure that everything goes according to plan and that. So in terms of, we were looking at starting something similar like a pensioner's day or something like that, but we haven't gone into that as yet. And we are looking at doing marketing also. We've done very little marketing. Shukar, majority has been through word of mouth. We've advertised in a few local newspapers and that. But other than that, it's just that, and we've had feedback from customers saying that we're happy with the product, keep up the consistency, keep up the quality, and you'll get us coming back.
Sounds good. But just keep in mind, if you're starting off with a pensioner's day, pensioners might have an issue with sugar intake, eh?
We've received quite a number of complaints as well from the ladies and the men as well, that now we're forcing them to go to gym and all their hard work in the gym is being undone by having to come have pastries and croissants and donuts and that.
Indeed.
So we just respond and say bismillah and eat.
I wish it was that simple. Eh? Okay, now, you know, the thing is, it goes without saying, on a bakery, you naturally have leftover baked products, unless you're doing very well and selling everything every day, right?
Yeah.
But what do you have in place for the disposal of leftover baked products?
Look, our plan at the moment, how we work things is, okay, we keep track of what we've sold from a previous week, so we more or less can gauge in terms of what baking we need to do for that day. And alhamdulillah, in most cases, if Mulana has noticed as well, that sometimes if you come around about after 5, 6 o'clock, whatever, majority of the stuff is sold out. And our aim is to rather sell out and bake fresh the next day. And then, unfortunately, if you come and you don't find the Swiss roll that you were looking for, you're then forced to try something else, be it a malt tart, be it a cake or something like that. But obviously, there is sometimes where you do get leftovers. What we do also, we support it quite a lot by the local industry around there. So normally, if like stuff like donuts left over, the next day they're still edible, they're still good to sell, but then we mark them down at a much reduced price, and that gets sold. And then we've also got a partnership with the local orphanage in the area, where they come and collect as well the previous day's bread or rolls or anything like that that's left over.
Quite interesting. Now, you know, I was just looking at doing some background checks in terms of La Bakery. Maybe I'll apply for a job there, but it doesn't seem like your bakery is listed on Zomato, right? Is it because the listing doesn't add much value in terms of bringing feed to the store or some other reason?
No, it is actually there, but the thing is, we didn't register it. We actually, one of our customers that came there, after they experienced what they bought stuff from the store, they actually went and registered us on Zomato.
Okay.
And then subsequent to that, we were contacted by Zomato. Mm-hmm. We had a meeting with them, and we went through it and saw what was needed in it. And for now, we've just left it as a normal public listing. We haven't gone the business listing route.
Okay, sure. Okay, so it is in the pipeline, possibly in the future?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, a final question, right? The cost of running a bakery is probably pushed even higher when you factor in food hygiene programs like HACCP and that of sepsis and so forth. But what has been and still is your greatest challenge in operating a bakery?
Okay, there's a couple of challenges. Obviously, your staff is critical. But then also, it's to keep that consistency and quality, keep that going, and make sure that our product is always of a high quality, and that the customer will come back knowing that I bought 9 years from this bakery, I will come back again, and that's the bakery I want to buy it from. And also, customer services. We've drilled it into our staff that you're not working in a retail store, you're not working in a fast food business. You need to make sure there's proper customer services. So that's what we just need to focus and make sure that we keep doing that.
Brother Khalid Qazi, jazakallah so much for your time on the Tajir Hour this morning, and we wish you everything of the best with La Bakery, inshallah.
Jazakallah.
Jazakallah khair.
Walaikum
salam. Walaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh. So that was that interview on this bakery, and I think interesting to see that somebody who comes out of the corporate world and he ends up in something totally different. Okay,
yes.
So I think before we go on to the comments of the day, some of our engineers indicating that there's a caller. We're going to go to the calls. Caller, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to ask Mufti Saab to please help me with an issue that we have. I am a partner with a Muslim brother of mine in a business. The arrangement was that, you know, the business would be run 1 year by him and 1 year by myself, and that the profits would be distributed every month to the non-active partner as well. And obviously that all documents and all records, financial records, would be made available to each party on a continuous basis for assessment and for evaluation purposes. The problem I'm having is my partner is now running the business for the past 2.5 years now. When it was his turn to hand it back to us, to me, he refused to hand it back to me. He said that he would continue running it and only keep me as a silent partner and give me the profit on a monthly basis. And he then has reneged on that promise. Within the past 24 months, he hasn't even made about 6 payments for the 24 months. And we keep approaching him, and he keeps saying, yes, I will pay you, and nothing seems to happen. He refuses to let me have any access to any records of the business whatsoever. And so we told him, look, this is not going anywhere. So the solution is either you buy me out or I buy you out. Or I find a third party to buy my share out. So I had found a third party to buy my share, went with all the documentation to him, with all the requisite monies available, and he scuttled the whole deal, and he refused to accept the third party that wanted to take over my share. Subsequently, he kept saying that please do not look for a buyer. I am going to buy you out. We had an agreement drawn up 2 years ago, which also he didn't subscribe to, and he's saying that, you know, he was going to buy me out, but please give me a term plan, and which I agreed to. That also didn't materialize.
Okay, I've got the essence of the matter, right?
Okay.
If you can either remain on air or listen off the telephone line. In terms of the matter at hand, I gather that there is a dispute going on, and it does appear to be going on for quite some time.
Yes.
In all fairness, the matter is unlikely to be resolved through an individual telephone call, and similarly, it does involve, by the very nature of being a dispute, would require intervention from both parties. So I would strongly appeal that you utilize a formal arbitration, mediation or arbitration structure, and our office does have an established structure which is operating quite well thus far. The Muslim Mediation and Arbitration Council is probably your best bet. I would prefer to rather have the matter looked into by experts before providing any kind of comment on who's right and who's wrong. There may be allegations and counter-allegations, but we've got to really be careful in terms of allocation of rights here. There is a dispute, there is an agreement in place, and if that agreement is in writing, all the better. An expert mediator or arbitrator can look into it and comment on the outcome of the case.
Okay, so that answers the question that the brother gave. We appreciate his call, and hopefully, inshallah, he will take you up on that offer that you made, and hopefully his whole matter will get resolved. And I think very, very important, you know, that is why in Islam it is so much encouraged that try and have things written down. You know, when things are written down, then it's so much easier now when there's a problem, there's a dispute, etc., to have it resolved, Musa.
Yes, definitely. You see, there's a few issues. One is the aspect of verbal agreements in Islamic law enjoy equivalent status of written certain agreements. It's just that people, the word of a person is generally very difficult to rely on. So it's, the Sharia and the Quran encourages it to be in writing. But be that as it may, in these matters, the dispute, the business naturally involves a few components, and one of them is just happens to be this agreement of management of one year, you know. But I suppose for us to comment on one version of events would become very difficult and in essence unfair. So the parties appeal to them to use the Muslim Mediation or Arbitration Council or even any other structure where you rely on an individual person as the mediator or arbitrator between both parties prior to moving ahead on the matter.
Okay. So the person, the brother that called in, if there is any other queries, you could probably call Mufti Saab after the program at the office, at the Jamiat offices, and then Mufti Saab would be able to explain to you more about the arbitration, mediation, etc. Mufti Saab, back to that interview that we had, we saw a brother that came from the corporate world and he jumps into the unknown.
Yes, Manana, it's something which it's very difficult to take the plunge. I mean, I know from my personal interaction before the interview with Brother Khalid, who I've met for the first time, in fact, yesterday, got to know him yesterday properly. The person was involved in the corporate world for close to 16, 17 years, and good position, you know, enjoying the best of what the corporate life has to offer, but just tired of it, you know, and just looking for other prospects and more fulfillment, I suppose. And taking the plunge is indeed very, very difficult. Only those who do it and eventually see a better future, you know, from a financial perspective, are able to say that it is the right decision. You know, it does take a lot of willpower, and apart from willpower and having the financial backing to take the plunge, I think a lot goes back to your spiritual leaning, you know, in terms of where your conviction is, because it's going into the unknown. You're moving away from a situation of having a fixed salary every month and knowing that X amount is coming every month. You know, you can spend this way, that way, you can plan, you know, because you know what's coming at the end of the month. But moving into an entrepreneurship role where you're starting your own business, your own brand, not joining a franchise, prospects of success are very unpredictable. It is a huge plunge, but eventually it boils down to conviction in another system, which is at play, and to your own benefit, inshallah.
Okay, and definitely also, you know, the in running businesses, and as we speak to these people, we really come to see that it's not just opening in the morning and closing at night. There's a lot of other aspects that come into the in this particular industry. You know, the worry of, as you said, the staff remains a challenge,
yes,
and maintaining the staff, maintaining the standards, etc. So,
just to take into consideration hygiene standards in running any food operation, there's a program called HACCP, H-A-C-C-P, which is an acronym for another very long term. But basically, for many of us, we understand hygiene to be, you know, you just wash the utensils, use some sunlight, and it's clean. But according to HACCP's program, it's a very costly program to run if you're in the food manufacturing industry. And lots of the larger corporations like your Woolworths, Checkers, Pick and Pay, they only source goods from a HACCP-approved plant. So running HACCP for a small bakery of 100 square meters could cost between, it's a thumb suck here, between 40,000 to 50,000 rand a month. Just to run HACCP, for them to inspect your equipment, your machinery that you're using to produce food items. The lower grade of HACCP is actually SEFSIS, the South African Food Safety Industry, something of that sort. They also have a program to manage the hygiene aspect of a business that is producing in the food industry specifically.
Okay, Mufti Saab, concluding on that interview, we'll now go to the third segment of our. Before we go to the third segment of our program, our engineer indicating that there's a caller online. Caller, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. You can go ahead.
Nice program, nice topic. Maulana, from experience, I've been in business for a very long time, and I'm now approaching my 70s. And that brother that phoned you in connection with the partnership and that had gone sour.
Mm-hmm.
I learned from a very prominent lawyer in Lens that in I had a couple of business dealings that went sour like that, and this man told me in Gujarati, now we have to resort to the sixth kalima, chatto kalima. In Islam, there's only five kalimas, but the chatto kalima is the law.
Mm-hmm.
You see, unfortunately, when you talk about the arbitration, the Muslim arbitration, if the person is not a practicing Muslim, then you are not going to get joy. This brother is not going to get joy, Mulana.
Yes, just keep in mind the Muslim Mediation and Arbitration and Council is actually law. The Arbitration Act has these mechanisms built in for individuals to adopt mediation or arbitration. And if you speak to any lawyer in practice currently, there is a very strong move away from actual court proceedings with full knowledge that the court is not what it is and what we perceive it to be. And our interests are actually taken care of in a much better way through mediation or arbitration procedures, which are very much in line with Islamic principles and managed fairly well with trained counselors or trained mediators and arbitrators.
Yeah, you see, only thing is in two or three incidents that I had in business dealings, eventually the only time the guy came to the party was when we threatened him to take him to court. This is the only language that, unfortunately, including our own people, when they resort to Nasara courts, that's the only language they understand. Anyway, Mulana, Jazakallah, I'll listen on it.
Jazakallah for your input. Yes, we do understand the Quran is very specific in terms of a system of law that we subscribe to. So we be very careful in terms of where we lean in terms of the use of law, you know. In Surah Al-Ma'idah, Allah Ta'ala is very explicit in those verses where وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ. You know, if a person doesn't decide on a matter using placing Allah and His Rasul first, then there's a different classification of that person, you know. And I think a lot in these disputes comes back to our conviction. When we have conviction, when we say we believe in the year after, it should translate to believing that even if I don't get my share or what I'm entitled to in this world, the real retribution is in the year after. That's what it means when you say "Amantu billahi wa malaikatihi wa kutubihi wa rusulihi wal yawmil akhir." You know, you say "wal yawmil akhir" because you believe that this is not the world for retribution. I won't get my share now. I don't have to have it now. I believe in the year after when retribution will be taken, and I will be given my fair share in the court of Allah Ta'ala.
Okay, there is only the only day when true justice will prevail, really be served. Okay, that brings us to the conclusion of that segment of the program. We now go to the last segment of our program, Fiqh of Commerce.
Fiqh of Commerce on the Atajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Tuzab, last week we rounded up the rules of leasing immovable property.
Yes, we looked at those six rules. We summarized those six rules that we talked about over the few weeks. That was about 2 or 3 weeks, I think, in terms of the leasing of immovable property. And I don't know if there's a need to go into all six rules again, but we have recapped them last week. Maybe very quickly I can look at them. The one was the aspect of when leasing immovable residential property or even commercial property, there is no real need to mention the specific person who will occupy it. And then linked to that was the aspect of when leasing immovable property, it is not the standard rule, the default rule is that you do not have to disclose the purpose of hire. However, in practice, the aspect of the purpose of hire being such that it will be detrimental to the property, in that case, it is recommended to disclose the purpose of hire. And then we talked of the aspect of the third rule of where the property is being leased out and the possession of the lessor are left behind. In that case, those possessions have to be detached and undone or removed from the premises prior to the lease going on, unless there's an express agreement where you know that equipment remains there. And then we touched on the aspect of the duty of care, which should be a given in terms of any contract of a commercial exchange, where the tenant, in the case of leasing, is responsible and not reckless in terms of maintaining their property, you know, not incurring any harm or damage to the property, which will be to the detriment of the landlord. And then the final rule was that of the landlord being responsible for all expenses which are to do with the primary purpose of leasing the premises, you know, fixing of a roof, you know, fixing of windows when the contract is starting, you know, those expenses are generally for the account of the landlord or lessor. And in the case where, yeah, during the tenancy, if the windows are broken, you know, as a result of negligence of the tenant, that's a different matter altogether. Mm-hmm. The tenant becomes responsible for that. So in a nutshell, those were the six rules that we touched on over the past few weeks.
Okay, JazakAllah for that speaker. Muftisab, this week, maybe we could take a look at the rules relating to the leasing of movable items. We looked at immovable items. We can maybe now move on to movable items.
Yes, and movable items, I suppose the whole issue of the Sharia touching on the rules, individual rules of leasing movable items is that you get the impression that you can only lease immovable, it can only be property, but these days it has become a norm to lease just about anything movable, you know, whether it's a generator, some specialized equipment, some tools, a car, you know, tables, chairs, cutlery, clothing, you know, just about anything can be leased these days. So there is permissibility. Rule number one is of permissibility of leasing of movable items. However, one has to just ensure that the specific remuneration which is going to be applicable in that lease contract is fixed. You know, the parties have to be certain in terms of what is going to be payable, I don't know, for per hour or per day or per month or whatever it is. That kind of certainty has to be there. Similarly, the certainty in terms of the time frame of the usufruct, you know, for how long will you be using the cutlery or for how long will you be using the generator or tools or whatever it is, the time frame has to be fixed for that. I'm just thinking aloud now that there are scenarios where the time frame is fairly flexible. And I don't know if this is a norm, I'm subject to correction here, but in leasing of, I use the example of chairs, tables and chairs. Sometimes there isn't so much of restriction. You know, the lessor, the person who gives out the chairs or tables, doesn't really mind when you return it, you know, as long as you don't take 3 months or 4 months to return it. It's a fairly open arrangement. So those contracts obviously need to be tied up. And I suppose nowadays, given the current, the prevailing practice, it is safer to identify and be more certain in terms of what the remuneration is, number one, and number two is what will the time frame be for the usufruct. So that's the first rule in terms of movable items. The second one is a very important one. You know, when you lease something movable, and you lease that movable item for a very specific reason, even though the item wasn't used for that cited reason in the lease agreement, the fact that the person retained the item, kept the item for a few days or 5 days, 10 days, whatever it is, remuneration still becomes due. So let's take an example. Let's say a person said, I'm leasing these chairs, tables and this cutlery for my son's walima, you know, and the walima didn't take place for due to some unforeseen circumstance. Now, it doesn't mean the lessee of the item can say, the walima didn't take place, so we're not paying anything. The fact that you kept the item for the 5 days or for the week or 2 weeks, whatever it is, requires that you pay. It doesn't mean you cited that reason and that specific reason did not materialize, so we don't have to pay. The rule is that the payment is actually due by virtue of possession of the item, not by virtue of whether it was used or not. It's by virtue of possession of the item that the compensation becomes due. So that is rule number two. And rule number three is that if the movable item is such that use of the item differs from person to person, in that case, there has to be a stipulation of which specific person is going to be using the item. And I think in the past weeks, Mulana had a question in this regard. But let's take an example of you know, my extra investment property I have on the beachfront somewhere, you know. I'm happy with you staying in it, man. Because you're my colleague, you're my friend, I know you, I know your living standard, I know you don't really do damage to my property, so I'm expecting you, I know what kind of person, what kind of tenancy will be in place if you are occupying it, but I have a problem if your neighbor is going to come, you know. Because I don't know him, I don't know her, I don't know what how do they live and what do they do. So just assuming that I used an example of immovable property, I should rather use an example of movable items, you know, where you maybe I lease my motor vehicle to you, and I want a specific person to be driving that vehicle, and this is exactly what happens in terms of the contracts. You actually agree that the main driver will be this person, you know, and if anything goes wrong, this person will be held responsible. That's what happens in modern day lease of motor vehicles. So yes, there has to be some kind of stipulation, especially in the case where the rule is going. The third rule is that if the item differs, use of the item differs from person to person, in that case there has to be stipulation of who exactly is going to be using the item. As a result, if there is no stipulation of who exactly is going to be using that item, it is possible for that contract to be rendered facit or voidable in Islamic law. It's possible. Because the owner of the item is not willing or not willing to enter the contract if someone else is using it. They're only willing to enter if person A is using it. You know. Secondly, that's one scenario, no stipulation. Second scenario is where there is stipulation, that only person A can use the motor vehicle. You know, in that case, only person A can use it. No other person can utilize the item. In fact, any other person utilizing the item will become problematic from an Islamic point of view, from an ethical point of view. Even though the lessor will not come to find out who drove the vehicle, but Islamically, you have an obligation to make sure that the person whose name you put on that document is the person who uses that vehicle. And the last and final scenario is where.
If I could just come in there, I see we're running out of time. But anyway, this is when you're renting, a car from a specific person, etc. But if you're hiring it from a car rental service, and like you're like four friends that are maybe going to Durban, myself and yourself decide to go to Durban, and I sort out the car rental, and I can allow you to drive?
A lot depends on what our contract will stipulate. Now, if the contract stipulates it's left open-ended, you know, there isn't, and that's the third scenario that we're supposed to have discussed now in a minute. Okay. That if it's left open-ended, then it's fine. Anyone can use the item. That's the third scenario. The second scenario was that where there is stipulation, only principal driver will be Mr. A. Waja. In that case, Mr. A. Waja only has to be driving the vehicle. And the first scenario we touched on was the aspect of where there is no stipulation. You know, and the use of the item will differ from person to person. In this case, there must be some kind of stipulation of who exactly is going to be using the item.
Okay. JazakAllah for that, Muftisab. We'll continue the discussion next week.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. We thank the listeners for listening. We thank the callers for calling. And with that, we terminate this week's program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.